Welcome to Supersized Science, where we feature research and discoveries nationwide enabled by advanced computing technology and expertise at the Texas Advanced Computing Center of the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Jorge Salazar, a science writer at TAC. Like a celestial beacon, distant quasars make the brightest light in the universe. They emit more light than our entire Milky Way galaxy. The light comes from matter ripped apart as it's swallowed by a supermassive black hole. Quasar light reveals clues about the large-scale structure of the universe as it shines through enormous clouds of neutral hydrogen gas formed shortly after the Big Bang on the scale of 20 million light-years across or more. Using quasar light data, the National Science Foundation-funded Frontera supercomputer at the Texas Advanced Computing Center helped astronomers develop PREA, the largest suite of hydrodynamic simulations yet made for simulating large-scale structure in the universe. On the line to talk about PREA is one of the developers, Simeon Bird, an assistant professor in astronomy at the University of California, Riverside. Dr. Bird, welcome to the podcast.
Could you speak to the main results of a study that you've submitted in, I believe, in September to JCAP of data? It's basically simulations based, they used data from the Extended Baryon Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey, part of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, released in 2020, I think pretty recently. And it used optical data to make three-dimensional maps of large-scale structure of the universe.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So what we did is we created a new simulation model to compare to this data that exists of the real universe. So the idea here is that you take the real data that exists and you compare it to a variety of simulation models with different cosmological parameters, so different initial conditions to the universe, different things in the universe, different matter densities in the universe, and you find the one that works best, and you find how far away from that one you can go without breaking the reasonable agreement between the data and simulations. And then you use that to say, okay, this tells us something about how much matter there is in the universe or how much structure there is in the universe. Our main results are the previous analysis disagreed with everyone else, right? So you can measure these things a couple of different ways. You can measure this with the microwave background experiments, with the CMB experiments, and you can measure this with large scale structure. And the previous analysis of these parameters did not agree with the CMB. And people use this to place really tight constraints on some things we're interested in particle physics. In particular, they constrained the mass of neutrinos to be very small, and they ruled out some of the early universe explanations for the Hubble tension. But the problem was, these were all driven by the previous analysis being in tension with other data, right? So if there are two data sets and they don't really agree, then when you analyze them to do pretty much anything, you don't get a meaningful answer, right? If I say to you, is the size of this apple the same as the size of this orange? Then the answer doesn't really make sense, right? So that was implicitly what people were doing before. And we made a new analysis with simulations that were a lot larger, that were a lot better designed, I would say. And we found that some of these things were in good agreement with Planck, that all the tensions before the work of the CMB disappeared. And then there was one thing that was still in tension with Planck, with the CMB. However, that particular thing is also, although it's in tension with the CMB, it's in agreement with everything else. So now this kind of fits much more closely with all the other experiments that exist. So in some sense, the main result is that we fixed a problem. In another sense, because the tension was used to drive these very tight constraints, you know, our tight constraints have gone away now. So another sense is that we've removed the tight constraints, which I guess in some sense is the opposite of progress. But in another sense, it is progress, because the new less tight constraints, you can maybe believe a little bit. I guess say the main result here is that our tight neutrino mass constraints went away and have been replaced with let's say, agreement with weak lensing measurements. Let's say that tight neutrino mass constraints were replaced with agreement, broader agreement with wider cosmology.
Could you speak to one of the focuses of the study, which looked at something that was described as the Lehman alpha forest? What's a simple way to describe what that is and why is that being studied?
Yes. Okay. So the Lyman alpha forest. So EBOS is a Lyman alpha forest survey. And the way the Lyman alpha forest works, so if you are in a car and you are shining your headlights through the night, you can normally see, you see sort of something reflected off in the distance. If you're shining your headlights through a dusty desert day in Southern California, you don't see as far, right? You see kind of dust grains that are interfering with the light on the way. And that is what the Lyman alpha forest is, right? So the metaphor is that the headlight is like a quasar, which is shining light at you from very far away. And along the way to us, that headlight gets interfered with by neutral hydrogen, which takes the place of the dust grains. And you look at this quasar and you say, okay, I see a lot of dust grains. That means there's a lot of dust in the universe. That means there's a lot of hydrogen in the universe. So you're measuring how much light gets you from this distant backlight. And because of you're using that information to work out how much neutral hydrogen there is in the universe. And this is the reason we call it a forest is because if you look at it in a spectrum, it has a whole bunch of little kind of dips and those look like trees. And so when the dips get put together, they look like a forest.
Could you speak to the suite of cosmological simulations that you and colleagues have developed called PREA? Talk about PREA. What are those exactly?
Yes. So the PREA suite, so these are a suite of large cosmological simulations. They're connected to the asteroid simulations that we ran before. So the asteroid simulations are all about taking a specific set of initial conditions and developing the rules to evolve them forward to the present day. The rules are important to make sure you have the right number of black holes, the right number of galaxies, and the right distribution of matter. And once we develop those rules in asteroid, we ran PREA, which takes the rules for asteroid, the galaxy formation and the black hole formation rules for asteroid, and changes the initial conditions. So by doing this, we take this model that we developed that matches galaxies and black holes, and then we change the initial conditions and compare it to the Lyman alpha, the neutral hydrogen gas, and the EBOS data. So asteroid is like for developing a single model, and PREA is for change the parameters of this model, change how the model begins, but use the same rules. And these, you know, these simulations, we have maybe 50 of them. Each of them uses about 300 terabytes of disk space when we store it. No, I'm sorry. In total, they use about 400 terabytes of disk space. Each simulation uses about 10 terabytes of disk space.
Could you speak to the challenges in these simulations and why supercomputers were needed to help you with them?
Yeah. So there are a couple important challenges. So the main challenge is these simulations are just really big. The memory requirements for them are so big, you cannot put them on anything other than a supercomputer. And you just wouldn't be able to, without something like Frontera, we just wouldn't be able to start them, right? It's not that it would take a really long time. They just couldn't run at all. And the reason for this is because, you know, like I said, EBOS is this huge survey. It observes most of the universe. So our model has to contain most of the universe. So, you know, we need a big simulation. We need a lot of data. And unfortunately, even though this chunk we're simulating is big, it talks to each other. So gravity works even over huge scales. So something 100 megaparsecs away can have a gravitational effect on something right close to us. And that's the thing we have to model. And there's just no other way of doing it but throwing just enormous computers at it.
What's the most important thing that you'd like people to know about using supercomputers to better understand the cosmos?
That it is a lot of fun. I think that's the most important thing. It's a lot of fun because using the supercomputer is something you can't do this any other way. And, you know, you end up sitting around, you set your supercomputer off simulating the universe, and then you feel really productive, right? Because you sit around and the supercomputer does the work, and then it brings the work back to you. Sometimes, you know, then you have to analyze it. But while it's on the supercomputer, you're sitting there thinking, hey, I'm making a lot of progress, but the computer is doing all the work. I guess our appetite for more compute power is kind of insatiable. That's the other thing. That if I had a supercomputer that was 10 times larger than Frontera, I would simulate 10 times the volume of the cosmos, and then I could analyze, you know, more data sets.
You've been listening to Simeon Bird of UC Riverside. Supersized Science is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world, brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the host and not of the University of Texas at Austin. For the Texas Advanced Computing Center, I'm Jorge Salazar.